We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management archaeology and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 191 for June 17th, 2020. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about recording the events going on around us right now and why we should do that. So keep protesting until we get some change, because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me on my non-standard setup without my microphone or good internet or even my own computer is Doug in Scotland.
Hey, everyone.
Steven in Calgary.
Hello.
Hey, I'm just going to mention here, as we're recording, it is June 7th, 2020. The world is a continuously changing place, and we're going to talk about some of that. So a topic that Doug brought to our attention that we could maybe discuss is something that I've had many, many discussions slash arguments over in the past. And that is looking at our heritage and how we can basically like what we should save and what we shouldn't save, how we should document things, how we shouldn't document things. What should we put up as a statue? What should we not put up as a statue? And we can get into some of the details on this. And then there's some people doing some really good, important work related to these things that Stephen was mentioning. But my common example of this topic, Doug, that you brought up is when I lived in the South and my wife is from Charlotte, North Carolina, and we would, you know, drive around for work and different things to these small towns in North and South Carolina. And you always see like these, not like 100-year-old, but like brand new, you know, last 10-year-old Confederate war memorials. There's not often a Confederate flag, but there might be a statue of a person that was important or some sort of thing where they're listing the dead, you know, the names of the dead that died in the Civil War. And while I don't necessarily have a problem with that, that was a conflict that involved the whole United States, even though it was a Civil War. I have a problem with the way that it's presented. It's presented as almost like glorifying the Civil War. I mean, these were, quote, heroes, yes, but they were also traitors. I mean, they were on the losing side. And it's not like we shouldn't forget the lessons and things that happened, but does this need to be displayed in a town in this new fashion? Again, this isn't like a 150-year-old memorial. This is a memorial that was built in the last 10, 15, 20 years with a lot of taxpayer money or possibly donations, I don't know, but it was built to do this. And it means different things to different people. You know, what do the African Americans in that town think of this Confederate War Memorial, this thing these people died defending the right to keep their ancestors as slaves? You know, how does it make them feel as citizens of that town? I don't know. So this is a topic that definitely something I've thought about a lot. So Doug, what were you thinking about when you brought this to us? What's going on these days that you've been aware of?
Well, now that we have to basically put dates and pretty much timestamp things in our podcast because things change so quickly in the next, like by the time we do this in 2 weeks, who knows, you guys could be under martial law or whatnot. So for me, it's 10 o'clock on the 7th at night. And I just watched a bunch of videos of people taking down a statue in Bristol, which is a port town in the UK on the west coast, just a little bit south of Wales. Mm-hmm. And so it was a massive port. Basically, most of it was built on the slave trade or benefited in some way from the slave trade. So either directly selling and, you know, shipping slaves, or as became the case later, they would have imported a lot of materials and stuff from the results of slavery. So that be sugar or later on cotton from the United States, mm-hmm. which then led to the Civil War, which leads to what you were talking about. And so there's a statue of a slave owner, or sorry, not necessarily an owner, but enslaver, I guess would be the correct term. So he shipped something like 80,000 people, 20,000 of them died on the way to the Caribbean and whatnot. And so he had ended up getting a statue. And like everything else with a lot of these sort of contentious statues, as it were, it actually happened way after he died. So they only put up the statue in 1895, if I'm managed to get mm-hmm. the history correct on that. And so, yeah, it was one of those things where they were trying to glorify the empire at that time, the British Empire. So it wasn't actually about him, and it happened well after he died. I mean, his shipping and stuff was the 1600s, 1700s. So tail end of the 1600s, beginning of the 1700s. And so, yeah, they tore down one of the statues. But it got me thinking about a lot more in heritage. So his statue, for some reason, is a listed monument. So mm-hmm. it has been declared historic of some importance. But it's thinking about our heritage. But I was also thinking about like how much of the archaeology we do and the heritage we have is actually kind of oppressive. And most people aren't around to speak about it, but like pretty much most any castle that's in like the UK was probably used at some point to like oppress the serfs and the peasantry. And, you know, they it's where they had their jails. It was not happy times at the castles. If you're thinking America, pretty much any plantation is not a great place. Even places like Mount Vernon and Mount Pilgrim had slavery. And so mm-hmm. I was just trying to actually think about like, you know, and even going further back. So like all of those, like the Assyrians, like everything that's in like the British Museum is basically statues of like some Assyrian king and how he like decapitated like several thousand people. And it's like reliefs of like stacking up hands and heads and, you know, actually quite a bit of our heritage and what we dig up is probably fairly contentious, probably fairly oppressive as well on different scales and different ways. But I was even thinking about, you know, when you're looking at sort of, you know, North American First Nations sort of stuff, not all of that is happy either. I'm just thinking of like the Four Corners where there's a lot of sites that have basically massacres of some sort slash, you know, they killed everyone in the hamlet was probably the right description, only a couple of, you know, huts, but they killed everyone there. They were all related mm-hmm. and then cannibalism as well. So, you know, I'm actually just thinking like, man, a lot of our heritage mm-hmm. has a lot of baggage with it.
Well, and one thing you mentioned too was, you know, some of these statues in a, like a museum or something like that. That's where I know we're in a lot of heated situations in a lot of parts of the country. And I'm glad to see as of the date today, June 7th, that there's a lot of, now that the police have kind of backed off in some cities and let people protest, shockingly, people are protesting peacefully. You know what I mean? Shockingly, in a sarcastic way, when the police aren't throwing tear gas in and letting people do it, hey, they don't turn into rioters, right? But now that that's happening, and some of these statues either have come down during the riots, which I understand, but if we can just structurally take these things down, recognizing the fact that they are offensive to a large portion of the population, and not things just related to African American issues or civil war. I'm sure there's lots of things in history where somebody thought, let's put up a statue or a marker, a monument of some sort, and honor this thing that happened, and then the culture changes, you know. But that's where it belongs, is in a museum. You know, don't take it down and destroy it. It does have some history and some cultural significance to a period of time in history. It should come down. It should come down, but it could go in a museum. So I don't know. As Stephen is saying, I think you should just shout this, Stephen. Just go ahead. Just shout it at the top of your lungs.
It belongs in a museum.
There you go. So
I'm going to be contentious. Does it?
Well, why not? There's so many things in museums that just don't reflect current thinking, you know, and current things that are going on from all kinds of societies. You know, I mean, there's things about cannibalism. There's things about other dictators and different periods of time in all societies where things didn't happen the way they do now. And a museum is where we learn from history. So, you know,
well, I say this in two ways because I can see a couple of problems with this. One is like, I feel like it kind of is kicking the can down the road, and we say like it belongs in a museum, but not all museums are equal. So like, I can perfectly well picture a lot of these statues suddenly going into, say, someone who's willing to accept that horrible statues, and that museum that's willing to accept it maybe is the White Power Museum of, I don't know, pick somewhere, or subtly racist museum of, you know, there's pretty much anywhere in the world that could be. But I think in general it's a good idea, but then it gets down to the practicalities. And man, that's going to be like a bit tough because not all museums will portray stuff in the way that most people think they will. And I also, not all museums can like accept. I think at a certain point, we're going to actually have to just say melt down some of the statues, because like that's just curation. Like museums deal with it all the time in that they basically need to decide what they can and cannot take. They can't take everything. I can already see that just sort of blowing up because you're going to see, so like they're going to say, oh, we can't accept this. And everyone's been like, oh, it should belong in a museum or something like that. And I think it's a bit of pushing the problem onto museums who are also like incredibly underfunded. You know, obviously they're not police forces and are not incredibly well-funded. Like I've suddenly learned that most city budgets are now like 40 or 50% police budgets. So I don't know. I'm a bit concerned about this idea of pushing it to museums without like following through. I don't know what your guys' thoughts. Maybe I'm completely off on this.
Well, my thought on that is, my joke about it, you know, belonging in the museum is more on the idea that it needs to, that here at this point with it being, you know, like the statues being marked up and removed and stuff like that, that this is an important teaching moment, right? Like this is, in a sense, would be like historic properties that, like meet the exception for the 50-year rule, because it's what we're seeing is like important historical events. There is some aspect of preservation that should be involved. Whether that means like going and actually putting it in a museum, or preserving the, you know, the foundations of the statues after the statues have been removed as some sort of memorial, not to the individuals, but to the removal and the historical context there, you know, these are things that are worth talking about, and we're talking about within the legal framework. Like all of a sudden you have cities removing statuary, and, you know, as they redesign the urban plan, you know, these spaces are going to have to come under review. And it's a way that, like, how are we going to address that is like, you know, as historic preservation professionals, right?
Yeah, I think so. I agree with you, Stephen. I do think this stuff does belong in a museum. One of the jobs of archaeologists and historians, as far as I'm concerned, is to document history, right? Our job is to document history, not necessarily interpret it. We do get into interpretation sometimes when the situation permits. But our job is to document it. And then it's up for others to decide, you know, well, what does this mean? How do we learn from this? How do we move on from this? And we can't just pick and choose our history. Our history is our history, right? Our history is good. Our history is bad. Our history is evil. And our history is awesome. You know, I mean, it's everything in between. And we need to wrap all that stuff in to a single package that says, this is what's made us who we are right now, for better or for worse. And if we don't like who we are right now, well, then we need to change it. And we can use the examples of our past to, in fact, change that. You know, like Doug was saying with the police and budgets and laws, I haven't really been following too much what the solutions are. But when people are calling for the defunding of the Minneapolis Police Department, I don't even know what that means. How do you replace that? You privatize it? I mean, somebody... In most societies, somebody has to keep law and order, and I don't know who those are going to be, because you can't really rely on citizens to do it unless you want to live in the Wild West. But it's interesting. So But this is going to be a good example for people to learn from as we're documenting these things. And I want to talk about current documentation efforts by archaeologists in the next segment, which we're going to go to shortly here. But it's important to document what's happening now, because now is history, right? Now is it's history in the making. And if we're not documenting what's happening now, then we're not going to be able to learn from this in 5-10 years, because even 5 months from now, even 5 minutes from now, heck, people are going to be back to their normal routines. I mean, we're like goldfish in this country and in the world, really. We learn from nothing. And that's why the protesters need to keep protesting. The police have backed off in a lot of places like Washington, D.C., and the protesters need to keep hammering it until there's actual change. And that's what'll do it. We're going to go to break here in a second, but we'll lose the chat. And I want to say Bill's perspective, because he's typing it here. He says his perspective is, one, leave it right there in the face of the Confederates who draw strength from it. He's referring to statues. Tag it up. Deface it however we want. Let Black Lives Matter and other protesters reinterpret it. Let those monuments stand for another 150 years so everyone can get a constant reminder of how we now feel about this. I get that. He says, don't take it down. Let's reinterpret this and let it stare them all in the face, every Confederate monument. Let them see it every day. I understand that perspective. I don't understand it as much as some people do, but I definitely get that. Let's take a break and come back and talk about some other issues on the other side. Back in a minute.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code CRMARC. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
All right, welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 191. And at the end of the last segment, we were talking about basically living through history in the making. And we were talking before the show started about documenting current things that are happening. We've seen spray painting on police departments, statues, things like that. We've seen, as we've already mentioned, statues being torn down. But there are other things. There's a lot of graffiti that's happening, and that's one of the things that is currently being done. To use an example, here in downtown Reno, we had basically one day of protesting and then riots. There's been a little protesting here and there, but it was really kind of just like one day that turned into a little bit of rioting later in the evening. And the police department was heavily tagged with graffiti, and so was downtown. We've got something called the Virginia Street Bridge, which is an iconic bridge in downtown Reno, brand new, built just a couple of years ago. But the whole thing itself is iconic, and it was spray painted with all kinds of stuff. But question is, should we be documenting that kind of stuff? Is it important to this movement? Is it important to the meaning and the cause of this movement? In some cases, I think, yeah, maybe it is, to really see the anger expressed in some of these expressions that are being spray painted on the bridges. I mean, you could imagine what's being done there. It's not like your quote typical tagging where somebody's going to leave their graffiti signature kind of thing, or do some sort of mural. No, it's very angry type of things. And should we be documenting that? Should we be writing that down? What does that tell us? What do you guys think about this? Steven, we were talking about this beforehand. So what are your thoughts on recording this information, and what do you think we could get out of it if we do?
Absolutely. I think that, I feel like we're kind of getting away from like our day-to-day jobs and you know, really our singular lane of like historic preservation on this. But I feel like recording things as they happen is an important part of life, right? Like, you know, that's kind of where journalists come in and stuff like that. But also us as citizens, I think we have the ability to, or should have the ability to, go and record things as they're happening. We all have cameras. We all have the ability to digitally record stuff. And a lot of fancier technologies like photogrammetry and stuff like that are becoming more and more accessible. And I think that it's generally better to be recording stuff and kind of sort through what it all means after the fact, right? Like, you know, trying to decide what things mean as they're happening. Like I don't know that this is it, right? Like, I don't know that, you know, we've had Black Lives Matter demonstrations and protests before in the past, and they've calmed down and essentially nothing's really happened. And everybody's like standing around saying like, oh, this is different. But is it? Like, you know, we don't know how this is going to play out. I definitely hope it is. I definitely hope that this is actually the sea change that we're all hoping, you know, like that people are actually working for. But, you know, the outcome is not certain, and the future is yet unwritten. So I think that there's a certain amount of documenting it while it happens is you know, a useful thing. On the other hand, I've seen a lot of concern online about that, you know, that this is potentially endangering the people who are in the protests because it's functionally evidence, and being uncritical about how things are documented during protests and stuff like that is problematic. This is not something like anywhere close to my, you know, expertise, right? Like, this is not what I generally do. I generally go out and dig holes and look in them. But like, I can understand the concern of, you know, how do we document what's going on around us without necessarily endangering the people doing it?
My bigger question is, I guess, you know, we can document the things that are going on around us, but what can we learn from that in the future that we can't learn from documenting the, I mean, we have a lot of video of what's going on. We have a lot of written things that are happening around and what's going on, but recording, you know, I don't want to change our rating to explicit, but F the police, you know, or something like that on the side of a bridge. What does that tell us that other things don't tell us? You know what I mean?
Well, it's adding an extra piece of the puzzle. So, I mean, graffiti is a huge, you know, there's a lot of archaeologists that look at that. So Roman graffiti was always interesting. Even if you didn't quite know who Cornelius was and why he was, I don't know. A lot of those, a lot of the Roman stuff was really X-rated in terms of their graffiti. Mm-hmm. So we probably can't repeat most of it. But, you know, it's interesting stuff like that. And I think it's also, in a way, it's telling a story that is likely not going to be told. In a sense that, you know, graffiti, if you're lucky, it survives, but usually it's wiped over either with other graffiti or taken off by city workers, you know, painted over, power hose to remove it. But it's interesting stuff, and it's almost like a social history. It's the history of, say, if we were talking about people in the past, we'd call them the common folk, the non-political class, the non-rulers, who are usually the focus of most of our heritage and most of history focuses on them and not the majority of people. And so it hasn't quite kicked off everywhere, but here in Scotland, there's a group, the Third Millennia Archaeologists. And so they actually look at basically contemporary archaeology, as it were. And I'm thinking of like Alex Hale, who's at Historic Environment Scotland. And he did this whole project where on his way to work, there's an alleyway. It's probably the best way to describe it. And so he decided to do a project where he was going to, you know, record it. And so just to give some background, Alex, before the merger, was with the Royal Commission, and their whole purpose is to record. So he goes out and he records. His job is to record heritage sites around Scotland of significance, and ones that are going to be sort of, say, listed, you know, put on a list of important sites. And in general, the most important heritage gets covered by his team And so he decided he wanted to take his skills and apply it to the everyday. And so he basically picked this alleyway and just took a picture every day. And it was really for a whole year. And it was super interesting to see a year, like 1 year in the life of an alleyway and how people interacted with it. Because it was mainly interaction with graffiti. And like halfway through it, he didn't know it was going to happen. The local government actually improved it and put up a mural and like cleaned it out. And so like it dramatically changed the entire look of the place. I'm pretty sure it was maybe a third or halfway through his project. And so if you were to ever like go back and look at it, if you were to look at it now, you would never know. It was actually a bit dingy, a bit rough, and had non-official graffiti on it. So there wasn't this mural that was done by an artist, and you know, it wasn't sanctioned art. It was art and words of people who lived in that area or relatively close. Some graffiti people travel wide and far, but relatively speaking, you know, it was that history. And that's a bit of history that's not going to get told. And we'd like to say that like, this is an important event, but as Stephen's mentioning, we don't quite know how this goes. Like there are certain, what's the fancy word for the fascists these days, or the popular one, alt-right people who are trying to start. The alt-right or whatever it is the polite way of calling the Nazis these days. But yeah, they're trying to start like a race war. And, you know, if they were to say start that and win it, guaranteed, unless we're recording it, that's not going to make it into any of the history books. So, yeah, I don't know. I'd say it's quite important to try to record this because it's recording the feelings and interactions of, say, people who are not, I hate to use this word, but like elites. So like as archaeologists, we're recording the everyday with this event, as opposed to like usually when we're recording stuff that happened for, you know, the political class of wherever the culture is. Usually, I mean, it's not everything. Lots of archaeologists do really great stuff with the people who are not the rulers of the society, but that tends to be the focus. So I would say it's quite important. Also because it, surprisingly, maybe the only record, like with digital stuff as well, you know, everyone has a camera now, tons of people taking pictures and stuff, but you know, most of the internet from the 1990s doesn't exist. Like that, we have the Internet Archive for a reason, but that's still like missing huge amounts of stuff. So like just because a ton of people have taken photos doesn't mean 10, 20, even like a year from now, those photos will be around. You have to take the effort to properly archive stuff and make sure that it's trying to be preserved. At least that's, sorry, I kind of rambled there for a minute there, guys, but it was just to say, like, you know, this, I think it's really important to do it. And I also think for a practical reason, people should do it as well, because it may not, that view of graffitied over Confederate statues, that may not survive the historical record in 50 years' time unless we do it.
You know, it brings up another interesting thought too, recording this history, because I was thinking, especially over in the UK, I've heard that like security cameras and street cameras and things like that are pretty much all over the place, especially in the bigger cities like London and things like that. But it would be interesting if it were almost mandated that footage was actually saved and sent over to the historical archives, you know, in whatever country that you're in, because it is, you know, once it's gone past a certain time period and the people that were there are gone, there's no longer really a privacy issue to worry about having that documentation of that street, because you don't know when there's going to be an earthquake. You don't know when there's going to be a fire. You don't know when there's going to be some other natural disaster that just takes it down. And having that snapshot of it is would be cool from a historical perspective, not only to see the event happen, but to document exactly when it happened. You know, that being said, I feel like as historians and archaeologists, we get a little too documentation happy sometimes. It's like, my God, how many more examples of, you know, insert thing here do we actually need? You know, now when it comes to architecture and events and cities, that I think is super cool to document over time how things change. So I see it as a little bit different, but yeah, more to your point, Doug, but I don't know. There's a lot of things out there that we could document that we probably should document. And I am all for documentation when it comes down to it. I'm probably trying to play a little bit devil's advocate here, but I'm all for documentation. And actually, probably to piss some people off right now, but I'm all for documentation over preservation. Because I think sometimes we try to preserve too much. And it's like, which snapshot or slice of history or persons or group of people's actual culture are you actually trying to preserve here? I go back to the mid-century modern drive here in Reno. And there's, you know, it's kind of cooled down a little bit. I don't know why, but there have been a lot of people that were trying to stop the destruction of these mid-century modern or 1950s and 60s hotels because they say it's characterized as Reno, but it doesn't characterize Reno because there was stuff before that that characterized Reno. And before that, there was Old West buildings that characterized Reno. And guess what? Before that, there were Paiute Indian villages that characterized Reno. And before they got there, there were wild megafauna and actually fish and other big things because this whole place was underwater that characterized Reno. So at what point in time do you say, yes, we're going to preserve all these things because this is our heritage? And I think that's a really hard thing to do in the United States because in the last 200 plus years over here in the West and 300 plus 400 years in the East, things have changed pretty rapidly from a historical standpoint. Whereas Doug, where you live, I mean, you walk outside your house and or look outside your window and you could see castles that are 1,000 years old and castles that are just youngins that are maybe 200 years old, right? But you see all these things, and that's one thing I've loved about going over to Europe and the UK is that it's an amazing mix of thousands of years of history. And that I think is super cool. But how do you create that in a relatively young country, in a relatively young place? You know what I mean?
To be fair, a lot of that's fake.
Yeah.
So no, I'm dead serious. So pretty much most places in Europe. So like if you've been to anywhere in Poland, anything that has a quote unquote historic look, all reconstructed. I mean, that all got blitzed, literally blitzed, the blitz with the Germans. And then everything after there. So there's Germany, anything that like quote unquote is historic has been reconstructed. And a lot of people do that even in Edinburgh. So they do a lot of sort of faux walls. So like on the Royal Mile, we lived right across from like the mm-hmm. Radisson Blue Hotel. It was fake stonework to make it look older. They put a facade on it to sort of somewhat blend in. But if you knew anything about like the tiniest bit of architectural history, you'd realize it was just complete, or as they'd say here, shite. And so like there's a lot of that. And actually most of the buildings in the UK pre 1911 or pre 1910, something like that, is only like less than 10%. That's something like 5 or 6% of the building. So most everything is most of the construction, most of the United Kingdom is actually modern-ish. I know it depends where you want to draw your mm-hmm. line on modern, but there's very, very little old stuff. And this is true of like most countries. A lot of it has been sort of reconstructed, rebuilt to look that way. But most, you know, a lot of wars have happened and a lot of things have got burned down over the years. And so a lot of it's kind of a fake facade, as it were. Sorry, I'm getting a bit distracted there. I'm moving us off the topic, but I was just gonna say it's what I wanted to bring us back to is, like I said, I probably wasn't making that clear earlier in the first segment, is like, I don't think we should save every Confederate statue. I don't think we should save every like statue to like a shit person in the UK. And there are so many. Like Edinburgh is having an issue right now with statues in that there's 100 and I'm going to get this number wrong, but it's roughly around 103 statues. Only one of them is to a woman. And there's actually more statues to dogs than there are women in Edinburgh. And so there's a huge debate. And like a lot of the statues are people who are pretty much scum of the earth. Like, at the time they were known as scum. Like, it's really hard to be like 1700 scum, where like your contemporaries were like, whoa, that guy was really scum. Because obviously they're all guys. But yeah, so there's a lot of stuff there. And I'm kind of with you, Chris, is that, you know, everyone's like, oh, take the statues and put them in the museum. I think some of them should be melted down. I actually think it'd be more symbolic and have a better connection with history if, say, you melted down the statues and rebuilt them as something else and then put a plaque saying that the statue used to be that of a Confederate soldier and that you've reused history and actually tie it there so that, a bit like Bill's talking about, like leaving them up. I'm not sure if I'd leave them up as so much as like recycle them. You know, be green with your, I don't know, it's hard to describe this, your repurposing of heritage. But yeah, I just think that we're just going to end up with like, oh, there's a list, isn't there? There's a list on the internet, like 500, 1,000 Confederate monuments and statues that we don't, and like craziest places as well, like Minnesota, I think before he left, Bill said something like Eugene, Oregon, like places that were on the side of the North have, you know, not appropriate stuff because they are all built way after the Civil War and basically the height of the Klan to intimidate people. So that's their history.
Right. All right. Well, let's take a break because we've got some comments about that. I've got some other questions for you guys to wrap this up from a CRM archaeology standpoint, you know, the name of this show. So we'll get back to that at the end of segment three. But for now, listen to these messages and we'll be back after this minute.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
All right, welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, our final segment, segment three for episode 191. And Stephen, you had some comments about what Doug said at the end of the last segment.
Yeah, I think the big thing is we need to remember that as part of what we do professionally, that, you know, we document, you know, what's there and kind of flag for like historical importance and stuff like that. But we're not actually the value keepers, right? Like that what's important as far as what's out there and stuff like that. You know, we developed that through consultation with the communities and stuff like that. And so the three of us sitting around talking about like what ought to happen to these statues, we're not the people who should be making this call, right? You know, like it's one thing for us to be discussing whether, you know, whether they should be documented, you know, just in case they're removed tomorrow, stuff like that. And how we as citizens who live in these communities, you know, like how do we talk about this with our families and friends and so on. But really, I feel like now's the time when we kind of follow other people's leads. Right. So particularly on this sort of thing, I think Bill deservedly gets way more weight in his opinion of what happens to these. And if he wants them kept there as you know, to remind people of that things have changed, then, you know, like that carries way more weight than any opinion about what happens to these statues like I might have. Right.
Right.
It also, like, something we don't talk about a lot in CRM and archaeology in general, as to piggyback off of you, Stephen, is that also remaining to think about recording as well. So there's, you know, when you're working with, like, say, a lot of Native American groups in the United States or Australian Aboriginal groups in Australia. Sorry, guys. I just said Australia. Like the three words I could have said, two of them were Australia. That was a horrible way of saying that. But like those sort of local communities, not everything is recorded by archaeologists working with them at the request of those local communities. And I do think also we should probably broaden how we do archaeology as well to not just focus on those, but all communities that are in the area of wherever we're studying or working. But it is a question of, you know, sort of taking Stephen's one step further is we have been, say, so all the photogrammetry models of the graffiti and the statues and stuff, it would be interesting to see how we as a profession and archaeologists handle it if, say, the communities decide, actually, we want no record ever of these statues ever existing. We want all photos, all preservation, all photogrammetry models removed. We want to forget about it that it ever happened. I'm not sure we as a profession have, well, I know we don't have any mechanism to actually allow that legally. And it'd be great if we could actually sort of think about how we could create a mechanism to do that outside of our legal frameworks.
You're right. You're right. I mean, there's not a lot of recourse for getting any of this stuff done. But, you know, in the last half of this segment, which is going to be a little shorter because we went long on segment two, I want to shift gears a little bit to asking you guys, really kind of throwing back to the beginning of segment two, where we were talking about documenting some of this stuff. And Doug, I think you mentioned, you know, protecting some of the people that are documenting current history in the making. And this isn't a new thing either, by the way, for people that are wondering. People have been documenting, for example, Jason De Leon has been documenting a lot the things that are left behind from people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border down in, I think, Arizona is where he's been working. But all along the border, mostly, I've been down the California-Arizona side, you know, that area, just seeing where, you know, what's happening in that area when people are crossing the border and what they're leaving behind. And he's been documenting that. And none of that's old. So how do we approach this from a Section 106 standpoint? How do we approach this from a what our job is standpoint? If you're on a CRM project right now, and I've worked on CRM projects where, like, the one of the first ones I did here for a company in Nevada was for a fiber optic line. And we had to walk all the sections where this fiber optic line was taking place. And a lot of that was in the city of Reno, like leading from like downtown Reno through parts of the city, and then following Highway 395 south. And then there were other cities that we actually had to walk through. I remember walking through Carson City just down the sidewalk. Now, if you're walking down the sidewalk on a Section 106 project, obviously, you know, when we were there, there was nothing that we had to look at. I mean, if there's historical architecture or anything like that, we would have the record search for that. And then you do the whole view shed thing with that from there. You know, is it going to be impacted by this thing? But if you're doing this during like the day after protests and maybe some rioting or whatever happened, but there's graffiti all over the place, you know, you don't really technically document that from a Section 106 standpoint, but you would document it from a historical standpoint, because, for example, things don't need to be 50 years old to be NRHP eligible. They need to be significant according to the criteria. That's why, like, the 9/11 site is already a National Register site, because it was significant to everyone in the country. So what do you guys think about that? I know, Stephen, what do you guys think about handling these things from a Section 106 standpoint? Doug, I know you're over in the UK, but let's say you were out doing some sort of CRM project like this and rioting happened the day before and you're seeing all these people documenting these things. How would you deal with this? Would you talk to your supervisors and say, I think we should record these things, like the graffiti and, you know, stuff like that? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, but also, like, even if there wasn't rioting, I would still say we would, like, I'm not the person to ask. So I'd be like, we should record it all just to, because again, within the legal framework, the emphasis is on, like, important events and stuff, which may not be what local communities view as important is not going to necessarily translate across to us or be picked up by the legal frameworks in most countries. So let's say you're walking along and there's a burrito stand and that has been in the community for like 30 or 40 years and they're ingrained and everyone knows it. And it's a focal point in the community. Most likely we wouldn't actually know that. So there'll be like historical, you know, investigations, and occasionally, on depending on the project, some people will be sent out to do some sort of ethnographic, you know, discussions with people. But that rarely happens in, say, urban areas and stuff like that. And so I mean, I would say that would be super important to try to document what's important to the local community, but I don't know how I would be able to spin that, or spin's not the right word, but I guess justify it in a 106 or just any, I guess I'm struggling to see how I could do it. I would hope someone else maybe has an answer to that, but there, or even here in the UK, because that there's even less of a ability to do that here. So I don't know. Do you guys have any advice on that? Because I can't think about how we do business now. How you'd be able to stop and have that conversation with people if say we were on a, sorry, Chris, was it like a fiber optics cable project?
Yeah, it was a fiber optic cable, yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't know how you'd be able to fit that into the project and how we currently put together proposals and bid for things. And then the practicality of, like, you know, you're on a schedule. Like, I'm pretty sure if you're walking through, like, you know, neighborhoods with just like pavement, your boss has already, like, probably assumed that nothing's going to be found there and has already, like, you know, calculated that out and is just having you walk through, but is expecting you to make like 8, 10 miles, 12 miles that day because there shouldn't be anything there. So in the practical way, I don't know how to do it. I think it should be done, but I have no idea how we'd go about doing it. I'll hand it over to you guys in case maybe you do.
Yeah, I don't know. Steven, what are your thoughts on this recording history in the making on a CRM archaeology project? As you mentioned before, a lot of times you're just out in the, I don't know, out in the wilderness of Calgary. But if you were in a more urban area, you know, how would you handle this?
Well, I think like for something like what's going on with the protests and stuff, it's really tough because it is like an exception, right? Like with 50 years, it might take a certain amount of discussion with, you know, beyond the SHPO, going to like the advisory council or something like that. Up here, it would be a little bit different. You know, I'd be calling the government directly and they would be making some sort of decision. Although I don't think there's a provision as an exception for the 50-year rule. The 50-year rule is probably a little bit more set in stone, but you know, you could bring it up and have a conversation. The problem is identifying what would be what's important and what's not, right? Like that's the perennial question for what we do. It's like just because we find a bunch of flakes doesn't make it an important site. So typically the way forward with that is you get the National Park Service, at least in the US, you get the National Park Service and they do what's called a historic context. And then from there, they identify a bunch of representative properties that would fit under the, that as being associated with these events. And then also, you know, like identifying, you know, the certain themes, like, so they'll identify like 5 or 6 different themes, the properties that fit these themes. And then you can use that as a guideline for the types of properties and types of materials that you're seeing. You know, like clearly this would take, I don't know, a certain political shift in who's manning the federal agencies right now, because I have a feeling that certain presidents of the United States might not smile upon venerating the protests. But yeah. I think that would be the way forward. The trick is in the interim, like that's a multi-year project and it's not going to happen until at least there's a new president, and then probably further on until like things are starting to kind of play out. So you can see exactly where this is going from a historical perspective. Like, you know, is this successful? Is this not successful? Mm-hmm. And even if it's not, you know, like the protests don't have to be successful for them to be historically significant. So yeah, like in the short term, if I were to go out tomorrow and do your, you know, your walkthrough, like there might be something relevant and there might be a lot of stuff that's related, but not relevant. And, you know, I don't know, talk to your SHPO. As far as the budget goes, hopefully that, you know, the idea that there might be historic properties is, you know, within the footprint was part of the budget. But yeah, you know how those go.
Quick question for Stephen there. The United States has a president right now?
We got something.
Shit, I don't know. I'm in Canada.
You mentioned the President of the United States. I didn't know that there was anyone in charge at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. So, hey, I think we're going to start wrapping this up because, like I said, we went long on that last one. But I'm interested in hearing the thoughts of our listeners because we have a lot of really intelligent people that are doing CRM. They're out there working. What are your thoughts on this? What are your thoughts on what we should record and what we shouldn't record? Do we need to wait 50 years for some of this stuff, or is it important now? And what's going on in your area? Because one of the things we didn't talk about was Canada. We didn't really have time to talk about what's going on up in Canada. What's being torn down? What kind of, are there any riots happening? I see literally none of that news down here. You know, I don't know what people are all upset about up in Canada, but other countries around the world are doing these sorts of things, and they all have their own issues that they're dealing with. So it's interesting, and I want to hear what's going on. I know we have some listeners over in Australia, and I know we have listeners in some other areas. And I think that's probably the most times of the word Australia has now been said on this podcast. Thanks for that, Doug. But anyway, so we're going to end right there. I wish Bill could have joined us because I know he has a lot to say on this topic, but this is hopefully not going to end soon. Hopefully, for the sake of our culture, we're going to keep protesting and we're going to keep talking about these things. So we might be bringing some of this up on the next episode. All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back again.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRMArcPodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
Thanks for everyone for joining me this week.
Goodbye.
Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye. I heard Stephen say it. You're the producer now, Doug. You got to step it up. I can hear you. Can't just be doing these things. Usually you're muted right now, but I can hear you typing and talking crap in the chat.
Goodbye.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.